If you're a B2B business, a B2B tech company, or a B2B marketer, you're in the right place. Coming to you from Studio 26, this is the Interesting B2B Marketers Podcast, bringing you interesting contemporary takes, industry tips, guest interviews, and true stories from B2B marketers in the trenches. Now, here's your host, Steve Goldhaber.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Studio 26 and the Interesting B2B Marketers Podcast. I'm excited to have Julie Knight on the show today. Julie, welcome.
Oh, hey, Steve. Thanks so much. And thanks for inviting me to be part of your podcast. And hey, everybody out there in podcast land.
All right, cool. Before we jump into the case studies, give us a little bit of an understanding of your background. So take it away.
Yeah. So I've been in B2B marketing for probably more years than I can count, but let's call it, 20 plus years. I have done everything from partner marketing to demand gen to product management. And now for the past couple of stints, I have been chief marketing officer. It has been a really fascinating and exciting ride and have met some of the best people across the business. I was at Cisco, where I was in partner marketing. I was then over at SAP SuccessFactors, where I started in field marketing and worked my way through up into running marketing for SuccessFactors. From there, I got to go to a little company, which many of you may know, called Zendesk, where I ran enterprise marketing, did two stints at startups where I was their chief marketing officer, and now I am a chief marketing officer at Udit4, a global ERP provider for the mid-market. And that's my journey, and that's where I am today.
Awesome. Thank you for the context there. So let's jump into case study number one. Probably my favorite thing that I like to talk about as a marketer, it's rebranding. It's the ongoing debate, house of brands, branded house, hybrid. It's just such a, it's a fun process for me because it's just so connected to like business decisions and market decisions. So time, like marketers are sometimes in all these campaign level things and tactical things, but when you really start talking about go-to-market approaches, that's exciting for me. So go ahead, take it away. Case study number one.
Yeah. So case study number one is a company in a mid-sized B2B company in the enterprise software space. It's a global provider. And I came into the company really to do a couple of things. First, it was to build or rebuild the marketing organization. It's a company that has gone through a lot of change. And but in terms of the investment of and the design and really sort of the marketing as we know it, that didn't really exist. The other thing is that it was a company literally that was a house of brands, and the house of brands were integrally tied to the markets it served. But if you took a step back, and that was as a customer, an employee, a potential investor, a partner, it was very hard to understand what this company did. And really, the only way that maybe you had context or a relationship is you worked specifically with people in a given market and with those product sets. But if you, pulled the lens back a bit, you didn't have context for much else. So we started on a journey that said, what do we want to be known for? What are the key products that really are applicable to a global set of customers? And which ones truly were products that are local in nature? And we went through a process. We worked with a great firm based out of New York to help us in the process. And it wasn't just rebrand. It was also repositioning. And finally, it was product rationalization. And, the steps that we took are very typical steps. We looked at the market. We looked at our position in the market. We talked to analysts. We talked to customers. And, through this process, we came to the conclusion, do we change the name of the company or do we keep the name of the company? And the decision was, the company name, it was kind of an empty vessel. It didn't have a lot of meaning except for perhaps a local market. So there was a lot that we could do with that. And so we stuck with that, but we really built off of what was our strap line or our tagline. And we centered on products that were global in nature. So they were going to be applicable in all markets that we served in the segment and we served in the verticals that we served. And through that process, we went through a brand redesign, a visual redesign. We redesigned the website. We completely changed the messaging and positioning and really tried to tie these things together so that they were relevant at a global level and really contemplated not only the verticals that we serve, but also the personas where we were trying to build relationships and ultimately working to sell products and services.
So, all right, here's my first question on this one, because this is tricky. You've got global, regional, local layers to figure out how it all ties together. Then you've got your industries or verticals. When I've done similar rebrands at that scale, you're just trying to figure out common thread lines.
Yeah, exactly.
How long did it take you to get to that thing where, all right, this is a really good idea, but it's also vetted as it relates to all these different scenarios that you have to account for as a CMO?
It actually didn't take as long as you might think. We put ourselves on a really tight deadline. So by midsummer, we were there. We knew what really sat at that global level. We had gone through the product rationalization. We understood what sat at the local level and how we were going to approach that. We had worked and really developed a strong 1.0 on the messaging and positioning. We had completely solved for and just made it Sesame Street simple on the product naming, which was just to use industry names, because we knew that we weren't necessarily known to all of our buyers. So if people are searching for things, we wanted to make it as easy as possible versus using product names or names that had been made up, you know, maybe 15 years ago that only somebody who had local understanding would really know. So from there, I mean, I'm not going to say it was easy, but we had ourselves on a pretty tight timeline. And then from there, we went very quickly and into design. We didn't try to do too much in the sense that we didn't redo the website. And in fact, the website wasn't redone until the following spring. But we did, you know, a home page with a couple of pages behind it to make sure that what we rolled out to the market, you know, what people were seeing in terms of presentations and other assets, what people were seeing in the media would tick and tie to what at least that top level website experience would be.
Yeah. Okay. Tell me about like how you got alignment on everything, because your job obviously is you have to connect to the leadership of the company.
Yeah.
You then have to say, all right, is sales on board with this? And then also the most important thing is, as a customer, is it resonating with them? So how long did that process take to juggle those different audiences?
Well, we did that in parallel. And in fact, the move or the decision to move forward with a rebrand actually started when I started. And it was something that the CEO and in fact, the board really supported. And we, at that time, were owned by private equity. And they believed that there was a lot of benefit in going through this rationalization and rebrand process. And then from there, we had different departments, you know, clearly product, engineering, sales, finance was even involved. I mean, we had all human resources. Everybody that needed to be involved was involved. The other thing that we did, and I thought this was a really bright idea, and it wasn't my idea, actually, it was the idea of others, to bring in our high potentials, our young talent, to make sure that what we were doing could resonate to really all age groups, because we know that within the buying centers that we serve, that we're dealing with people that are just coming into roles on maybe just a couple of years out of university, all the way through to new people managers and obviously senior leaders who had been in the business for quite some time.
Yeah.
So we knew we needed to tackle a couple of different generations and we couldn't limit it to our own bias.
Yeah, I think that's great. I don't hear that a lot, but it makes sense. The challenge usually is the people in organizations who are running them have been doing this for a long time. Maybe they're only going to be around for 5, 10, 15 years.
Right.
So the fact that you did go to younger folks to make sure it resonated with them, I think that's I think that's a good move. So what was the outcome of all this? You know, you mentioned that it rolled out in different phases, the web launched afterwards, but what was, like, collectively looking back at it? How did everything work?
You know, we did an official launch at an event that was held, actually, it was a trade show that was in one of our target markets, and it tied very well with the strap line and really sort of the key themes that resonated and were woven throughout the messaging and positioning. So it tied very well. You know, there was, as you might expect, a full-on media plan. We also spent a lot of time on internal communication. So what did it mean for our employees? Why was this important? What would it mean? And how did it, you know, how would that thread work through with what we were doing for people experience through HR and other meetings? We also took it as an opportunity to really start to accelerate our internal communications. That's something that was sort of hadn't really taken off. And it was really a focus for our CEO. So we used that as a launch point to really build that out. And I think codify those channels and begin using them in a much more structured way. So you think about the internal and you think about with customers, through partners, and ultimately with our investors. So there was a couple of different stages. And then it was continuing the drumbeat, building upon that. And then obviously we had the rollout in the following spring of the website,
yeah,
which I think really, you know, it gave people a way to engage more deeply and with a lot of content then that very much tied to what we were doing across the brand, across product.
Yep. Yeah, it's funny. Mike, I'm in the 20 plus year club too. So we have that in common. But I started out in B2C marketing right out of college. And I just always remember the luxury of, like, well, you just do a rebrand, you buy a bunch of media and you're done. And jumping into B2B a long time ago, it was just like, it's way more complex. Like, the customer facing thing, even though that's the most important, it's often the least effort to get there, right? It's the internal and the partners and the employees that are really...
It really is. And, you know, you really have to bring people along in the journey. And the employee piece may end up being the most important, because they are going to be people that are your connection points, are going to be talking about the reasons why, what does it mean? What does it mean to them? What does it mean to whatever audience they're speaking to? So that became a big focus. At the time, we also launched a social advocacy tool so people could begin to use social, again, in a more structured way, in a way that made it easy for them. And it wasn't just, you know, corporate propaganda. Certainly, there was, you know, information, there were customer stories and press releases and other things that they could share. But equally, they could promote, you know, those topics that were important to them through those channels. So that became a key tool for them as part of this larger effort.
Yeah, I love the social advocacy. And I think what you said is important is anyone in charge of a program like that has quickly learned, oh my God, I cannot turn this into propaganda because people won't share it. Well, I think it's a great challenge to any marketer to truly say, if the content isn't interesting, it will not be shared, and you have no reach through your employees who share it. So it's always fun to create a win-win. All right, anything else you want to share about the first case study?
You know, I would just say that, you know, most of your audience is going to know this, but I would say for those, you know, coming into marketing or maybe being swayed to, you know, we need to just change the color palette and throw up a new logo and a few other things, that, you know, take a step back and really start to map out all of the different touch points and, you know, why is it important to them? Is what you're doing, is the message authentic to your audience, to your employees, potentially to your investors, your partners? Really do take the time to do that homework. Do speak to customers. Do speak to your other people that you know that have been through the process. There's a lot of learnings out there. And also take the time to check, you know, what others are doing. Not always necessarily competitors, but who's doing it well in the market? And I think that there's a lot of things that one can take and start to put in, I'll call it the salad bowl of idea to help you shape out what your plan is and rigorously pressure test. Don't be afraid to have people challenge your ideas. But once you make a decision, you do have to go because there's a lot of work that's got to come with bringing this to life.
Yeah, I love that you just said kind of let's look outside the competitive set. I was working on a brand once that just was not known. The whole category was just non-innovative. And we were like, well, we're just looking at the competitive set. And my whole point was, there is no innovation in this category. Why would we not look?
Why would we do that? Yeah.
So other categories who are more innovative.
Yeah.
So yeah, don't get lost in the sea of our competitive set. Because that's the old classic limiting belief. You've just put a cap on creativity or innovation. All right, cool. Let's jump into case study number two. This one's going to be focused on account-based marketing.
Yeah. So much like the first mid-sized B2B tech, this company was going through, I think, kind of like that go-to-market identity crisis. What do we want to do? Who do we want to talk to? Wow, a lot of people should be really interested in what we do. So we're just going to throw a big net and see what we get. And you know, what you soon find out is actually that's not the case. I mean, you as a buyer, I don't want to be treated that way. And there's, certain things that, categories of products or products that I wouldn't be interested in. So probably not going to respond to that. But at the same time, in the world that this company was in, the idea of focus was even more critical because there was a lot of money that was being spent. It was being spent unnecessarily. And equally, people's time, especially those on the sales side, whether it was sales development rep, an account manager, solution consultant, a lot of time wasted on opportunities that would never see the light of day. And so we took the decision that it was really time to get focused. But the first lesson was it couldn't just be a marketing-driven initiative. It really needed to be embraced across the go-to-market. And so it had to be an account-based go-to-market. And people really got behind that. And I think, that came out of the fact that, the products demanded it. The customers demanded it because there was a vertical play. There was a segment play. Regionality came into focus. That an account-based go-to-market was necessary. So they had seen and had lived through the net phishing exercise, and everybody pretty much realized that didn't work. Of course, there's a couple of iterations about what is the true ideal customer profile or ICP, but in large measure, people got to agreement, and then it was just a matter of starting to pull together the list of accounts. Some of those were, accounts that already had existed in the TAM that we had. But I think more broadly, it was, what is this account-based go-to-market going to look like? How are we going to self-organize? So how do you structure the sales organization or the go-to-market organization? And then as we, pull in the aperture a bit, we start to look at marketing. And the reason why I think this worked really well is that both marketing and business development were very joined up in making this a success and making it a reality that could benefit the go-to-market organization as a whole. And so we had started with your traditional static ABM. Let's get those lists. Let's start to prioritize. Let's start to do some marketing. And what you quickly realize, and in particular in the product category in which this company was in, buying cycle or customers aren't changing out those solutions on a 3-year basis. It's maybe 10 years. It could be 12 years. There's other products within that organization that could have a faster or maybe a shorter shelf life. But generally speaking, these all have long shelf lives. And so with that, the idea of bringing intent, bringing knowledge of of the personas, understanding more about the persona, really having marketing taking the lead in bringing in accounts, moving them from a TAM into an ABM where we knew that they were active. We could see those signals using various tool sets. And then from there, we would see a higher degree of engagement and conversion once it hit the BDRs. And then from there, turning it over to sales. And then the other piece that was super beneficial is that all of that could be seen within the CRM so that instead of, you know, taking the word of the marketer or taking the word of the business development or just having that qualitative understanding of what was going, which is still really important. Let's not negate the importance of a qualitative understanding of the readiness of a particular buyer within an account, but also what is the data telling you? What is the engagement rate telling you? How is it scoring? And then even after an account may have turned into an opportunity, how engaged is your primary contact, but also all of the others that may be part of a buying committee. So it was a powerful shift. It provided insight. It offered avenues for our sellers to broker those relationships and really help them as they were working those opportunities, you know, hopefully into closed one. And I think the other thing is it was faster time to insight. So it wasn't a lot of spending, whether it was the business development rep, the marketer, or the seller doing a lot of, you know, their own research, though that still remains important using a variety of tools. You know, it could be LinkedIn, you know, searches on website, whatever, you know, whatever platforms and sites that you might use to understand websites and so on. But it's, you know, what we had, you know, resident in our own stack that could help, you know, find a couple of those nuggets that allow them to have more meaningful conversations. So I think, you know, that was an important component. And then the other component, which we started to use on the existing business side, was if your client is coming up for renewal, what's happening out there, you know, in the world of search, right? Or what have you, what signals are there? Could they potentially be looking? Equally opportunistically, could they be looking for other products or solution sets that you might have? So there was a lot of benefits, some maybe not originally intended because it was very much for the new logo or new business motion that could help us in other areas of the business. Yeah. So, yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that because some people look at account-based marketing purely as a prospecting strategy. What you're describing, which is what I love, is you got to take it all the way through to how you manage your existing customers. And I was working with a company that embraced both of those approaches. And what was fascinating was we would analyze the content consumption of their accounts, and you could directly correlate that to likelihood to renew.
Yeah.
And, you know, marketers often look at like, well, our role is to put messages out in the world and help people think differently. The power of all that content production that we were doing was in the flagging to sales, you've got a problem here because this customer who should be engaging is not. That means like there's a relationship issue or they're looking at competitors. So I've seen content programs still, you know, with good intent, help shape opinion and help people solve problems with content. But the value is really is just, it's a great flag for, are you going to retain this customer?
Well, and you know, I mean, we do it in B2B all the time, right? Is that we have kind of these dividing lines between new business and existing business. Maybe you have your key accounts. I mean, it just depends on the organization and the segments that it serves. But generally speaking, there are walls between and there are teams that are dedicated. I am fully focused on new logo. I'm fully focused on cross-sell with an existing business. And sometimes you're so immersed in the area that you're in and meeting your targets that you don't think more broadly about the customer. And the customer has different relationships with a vendor at any given time. You could be an existing business customer, but you have a department within that account that in all effect is a new customer because they're considering a different solution for you. So you have to understand all of the different motions, if you will, or activities, and journeys that these accounts are on. And then I think if you look at it in that way, again, you can just turn it inward and think of yourself as your own buyer. You know, you buy a computer, but you might buy a phone from this vendor. You might buy something else from this vendor. You're on different journeys at different times. And we as marketers can use a lot of these tools to that end. And if we think about, you know, joining up between marketing and sales and customer success and our partners, you realize that there's a lot of people in the mix and that it is a better together strategy, and the tooling and the platforms that you have really can bring so much to that.
Yeah. I'm always fascinated with buyer behavior. I think even in a scenario where you could look at data to predict, are they going to renew or can you sell them something else? The one thing that's always like unspoken is the buyer leaving their job in the next 12 months? And it's such a funny thing because like you always assume that like everyone's active in their role. They're doing what they should, with good intent.
For God, being there forever.
Yeah. No. Like some people are like, look, I'm round three deep in an interview. So I am not focused on any long-term project or drafting an RFP that's going to take me 3 to 4 months to execute. Well, so
no.
It's always funny, like the unwritten rules that we learn about buyers that, of course, the buyer's never going to reveal that unless you really know. You know, you've got to have a pretty strong relationship.
Person. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the flip side of that is you can have somebody that's going through that process and, you know, they find the opportunity of a lifetime, right? And it, you know, how well, you know, customer experience is often the last thing that you bought or maybe were in the process of buying, and how good was that experience? And maybe, I left this job, I'm going to this company. Wow, I really like that rep. I like what they had to say. I like the company. I'm taking on this thing, and my remit is to take some stuff out or find some new technology and, you know, to do some new things. I'm going to go give them a call. So it's like, That journey just doesn't mean a given an account and in a given company with select products. Journey can extend to I'm moving on to something else and it could be even bigger and better. So
yeah, it's funny. You know, the most exciting day, if you're a B2B company and you've got a really good product or service, the most exciting day is when your customer says, I'm leaving the company to take on a new role. Because at that point, you should have already cemented yourself as a provider.
Yeah.
So they're not going to fire you if you're doing a great job. And you just have your number one lead, you know, that you've got a relationship with, go to a new company. So that's always an exciting time for me as like a barometer. Are you effective as a B2B marketer? Is because it should be an exciting day. But so many times that people are just like, oh my gosh,
I'm going to start all over again.
Yep.
And hopefully that's not the case. And, you know, if the go-to-market is really joined up, it's, you know, you should have visibility and you should have relationships elsewhere, either within the buying center that you sell to or more broadly. And I think to your point, be very excited. I think there's a lot of companies who shall go unnamed who have a Rolodex filled of happy customers that have either gone to other companies or, you know, they've gone on to build a new company.
Yeah.
And it's an opportunity to restart that relationship and potentially make it a successful one from a monetary perspective.
All right. Thanks for sharing the two cases. We're going to jump into some Q&A. Tell me about your first job in marketing.
So my first job in marketing, while I was going to college, to university, I worked in engineering. So that's not my first job in marketing, but that's how I got started. And I'm not an engineer by trade. I actually have a degree in history. Don't try to weave that thing together. That's a long word. That's a podcast in and of itself. But I had the opportunity to set up an executive briefing center. And that's how I got the foot in the door. I knew a lot about our technology. I actually spent a lot of time with customers and meeting prospective new customers because pretty much at that time, you know, people kind of did everything. And so set up the executive briefing center. That was my first step into marketing. And from there, within marketing, there was both product marketing and product management. And my official first role was as a product manager.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very classical role. I like that. I remember after I graduated, there a lot of my friends who were in marketing went the CPG route, which was such a scientific position. Like,
yeah.
Which I was always like, there's just not enough creativity in that for me. You know, like maybe you could do like an ad campaign that kind of was interesting, but like they were looking at barcode data and just they were pushing buttons. Yeah. Based upon all the data. But it's a good foundation because, again, you start with a really well-run way to operate a business. I'm going to ask you, you've been CMO a couple different companies, and it's a really fun role. It's a demanding role. How would you describe it? Like, what are some of the unspoken truths that CMOs have to go through every day?
So, I mean, number one, you can't know everything, but you can't shy away from the details and you can't shy away from the problem areas. You know, I've always been, and it's why I think being a CMO at two startups as the first step into being a chief marketing officer was super helpful because my teams weren't very big and I was very much a player manager. And I did a lot of playing on the ball field. So everything from working to get systems set up to doing a lot of writing to working on campaigns, I mean, very hands-on, but you have to understand the business and you have to understand how things get done and also, you know, as you get into larger organizations, you know, you can't be the one always doing the build, but you have to be able to guide and to help so that, you know, things run efficiently, they run effectively, and also you can help scale, right? Because these organizations need to scale, and in the tech world, they have to scale really, really quickly. They also have to adjust. You know, we had the pandemic a couple of years ago, and if you weren't adjusting, then likelihood your business, or at least, you know, within marketing, you'd be very challenged to keep pace with what you needed to deliver. I would say the other thing is when you come in as a CMO, and if you have experience in particular areas, or you're coming into an organization that doesn't necessarily, you know, understand whether it's, you know, vertical marketing or enterprise marketing, I mean, they have strengths in other areas. Jumping in and just doing and saying how this is how it's going to be is really not a recipe for success. You've got to bring people along the journey, spending time educating people on the why and how they can be a part of it. People will tend to be a bit more supportive when they understand why and maybe how they can participate in whatever change is going on. If change is just forced on people, usually there's pushback. And especially if a company has had a lot of success in another segment or category or whatever it is. So I think that's it. And I think the final thing is you're there to lead, but you're also there to serve. And being a humble leader, being a supportive leader, helping, having, you know, an open door really does help. You know, you need to understand, you need to be empathetic, and people like to know that you have their back. Obviously, if things aren't going well, you sometimes need to have those tough, candid conversations. But at the end of it, people at their heart want to do a good job and they want to work with a leader that is right there with them.
Yep. Makes sense. All right. So my next question, you've had the chance to work with a lot of different CEOs. I will stereotype and put CEOs into two camps. It's marketing's great. I love marketing. I need marketing. And then the other one is kind of like, sales is where it's at. Yes, marketing has a role, but I'm not going to embrace it. So I'm going to focus on the more challenging CEO who doesn't see as much value in marketing. What are some things that you've done to build that bridge so that you could take a CEO or an executive to kind of say, you know what, you've changed my thought about how marketing can help me grow the business. What are some things that you've been able to do that just are more eye-opening as opposed to the other path, which is like, oh yeah, they already get it. They know they know the role?
Yeah. So there's a couple things. First and foremost, if a marketer, and sometimes it's, you know, the highest level is a director of marketing. And you do see that a lot where marketing is maybe less appreciated than you know, other aspects of the go-to-market. But joining up with that head of sales, because that head of sales actually does need marketing and often, you know, maybe a little more quiet or reserved about, you know, the M word when they know that the CEO isn't exactly thinks of it more as a cost center than in what it can bring to the table. So joining it, you should, as a matter of course, regardless, join up. But I think that's one way. You do a little brand borrowing, you come in with the plan together. The second thing is really understanding what are the key drivers for that CEO. So marketers shouldn't stay just as marketers, they're business people, right? Just as salespeople are not just sellers with a territory. They are, you know, sales executives that run a business. And we all run a business within the larger organization. So being able to speak to that CEO in business terms and how marketing can help, and also understanding, you know, maybe what biases they have. A CMO should have a good open line with the CEO. And, you know, what are the things that got them to that position that they thought marketing couldn't help? Sometimes it's marketers just showed up with, you know, likes and click-throughs and leads, but yeah, it didn't really, they weren't bringing it down to what is the business value. And then I think that, you know, the final thing is, you know, part of marketing, just like we're doing today, is having your CEO or C-suite out there talking about the business, talking about themselves, you know, why they're passionate about what they do, maybe why they're passionate about, you know, the technology sector that this company is in. And that's all marketing. It's just a different part of marketing. And you get people kind of hooked on that and hooked on the power of sharing the message. And then the other piece that marketing, you know, ultimately is a steward for is on, you know, existing customers. And, you know, whether it's a reference program or customer marketing or customer events, there's ways to bring people in and you start to get them, you know, hooked on it a bit and have them start to see the power. And even if it's just the power of, wow, I got in a room and talked to customers and it was a really incredible experience. It's all about experiences. Our relationships are about experiences. And sometimes if you've had a bad experience with a particular function, you sort of say, ah, no value. And you've got to bring them back in. And what are the business drivers? And ultimately, how I can benefit. But it's a journey, like everything else. Yeah.
I think I really like your answer there. I mean, I've always believed in the two-hat system where you get to a certain level in marketing. That's one hat you're wearing. You have to wear a business owner hat because that's essentially your passport to the boardroom, right? If you know how the business runs, then you've got credibility to then say, she gets it. Now that you're in the circle of people who want to run and grow this business, now tell us how you can help us.
Yeah,
there's a lot of marketers who just had that one hat and they live in the brand world, which is needed, right? But you can't just live in the brand world. The brand world needs to be one thing.
Yeah, absolutely not. And again, you have to understand where what the drivers are, the pain points are really, you know, also what is the board asking them to do? Like kind of get an insight as to what's going on there. And then there's ways that you can figure out, you know, how to help, but bring them in maybe easier ways for them to consume marketing and where they can play a role versus maybe areas that they don't understand. It's not something that they want to get too close to. Like, you know, sometimes this MarTech thing, too much. But if that's what you focus on, then you lose them from the start.
Yep. All right. Well, Julie, I really enjoyed the conversation today. Thank you for joining us here at Studio 26.
Oh, it was my pleasure. It was great to share some of the experience that I just had along the way. It's been a great journey through small companies, mid and large. But as I like to say, it's really been about the people and meeting some fantastic people along the way. It's been a great journey and one that I'm excited to continue.
All right. Awesome. Thank you again. And thank you to all the listeners for watching and listening. And some of you reading, right? We're multi-channel marketers here at 26 characters. So you can get the content many ways, but Thanks again for listening, and we hope to see you next time on Interesting B2B Marketers. Until then, take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in to the Interesting B2B Marketers podcast. Be sure to subscribe wherever you heard this podcast so you never miss an episode. If you found value in today's episode, please help grow the podcast by sharing with others and leaving a review. We'll see you next time.